From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the first segment in a series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order from historical and contemporary perspectives. What's the status of Afro-American writing? How has awareness of black writing among popular and academic audiences changed over the last quarter century? Addressing those and other questions are four scholars who have recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center: Houston Baker, James Olney, John Sikora, and Blyden Jackson. Houston Baker teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. James Olney is a professor at Louisiana State University. John Sikora teaches at North Carolina Central University. Blyden Jackson is Professor Emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The program begins with comments from Houston Baker about the status of Afro-American literature.
I think I'm happy in a sense that perhaps is everyone's sense when it comes to happiness. I'm happy in a relative sense. I'm a lot happier than I was 15 years ago about the state of the art where Afro-American writing is concerned. 15 years ago, there were very few people that one would meet in the course of ordinary comings and goings who had any notion of Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, Toni Morrison, the general body of now, I think, fairly well known and in some instances popularly, nationally acclaimed authors. Toni Morrison's appearance on the cover of a national magazine with a splendid story inside advertising her most recent novel, Tar Baby, was a striking phenomenon that one could not have conceived 15 years ago. You know, I think that one of the things that becomes necessary fairly early in any discussion of Afro-American literature and writing is the practical consciousness from a Marxist standpoint, orientation, or from a more everyday discourse standpoint, the social activism that has always surrounded Afro-American writing. I think if one were to look for an important date or a significant date within the last two decades, it would be 1968, and it would be the assassination of Martin Luther King. I would pick that date because it seems to me that that King's assassination brought about an immediate reaction within the academic world, and that immediate reaction in the academic world was one of funding courses, setting up black studies programs, appropriating funds to buy books for the library. But at a larger level, a more theoretical level of literature and politics, it seems to me that the division in itself implies a kind of naivete if one accepts it. I mean, I'm very gratified by the title of Leslie Fiedler's new book, which is What Was Literature? It seems to me that once we can destroy literature as a pole at the other end of politics, or at the other end of protest writing, or at the other end of economics, and realize that the division of literature, the separation of it out from everyday life, represents a one move of bourgeois aesthetic theory. I mean, it's a rather recent phenomenon. People don't live that way, and they never have. The fact that we've accepted that kind of division, I think, speaks about certain class interest, and especially in this country.
I think one should observe not only that books that are coming out now by black writers are much more generally reviewed than they would have been, say, 20, 25 years ago. If you pick up the New York Times Book Review, you find very frequently reviews of the reviews of Toni Morrison or whoever. But going along with that, I think one should observe that when now in the general public awareness, I think, or particularly the academic awareness, when you refer to work like Black Boy, say, or Langston Hughes's poetry, people, I think, have a different perception of it now from what they would have had 25 years ago. And I think they recognize now that, say, Black Boy is a classic of American literature. And they don't think of it so much as they used to as a particular statement from a particular aggravated writer in the black community. Now seen as simply in the at the center of the American tradition, I think. And that's an important change, I think, in the American perception, the general American perception of the quality of Afro-American writing.
Jim's point is perhaps the center of my concerns about the present state of Afro-American literature, that to a large extent, much of what we're concerned about is rewriting the canon of the accepted standards, classics, not just of American literature, but of all literature. And there is something necessarily wrong with an educational system that doesn't view Black Boy, Native Son, Invisible Man, Song of Solomon, Man Who Cried I Am, some one or all of those, as accepted classics of our national literature.
Who's supposed to do that, John? Who's supposed to line up the hierarchy? Who's supposed to arrange the canon, as you say? How do you figure out what comes where in what students are reading?
It goes both ways, Wayne. I think that scholars reflect a mass reading audience when there is one, and they also help create it. It's undoubted that publishers ask people like us once in a while, maybe once in our lifetime, what should be reprinted, or to do introductions to works that should be reprinted, or to select names of authors who should be cultivated, who should be known more about. But at the same time, I know that we all read the bestseller lists in the New York Times Book Review, just like everyone else, and we know the market rate for a given given author.
I think this discussion began on what I consider a very intelligent note, the reminder to anyone who listens to it that the basic difference between the condition of Negro literature, Afro-American literature, Black literature, whatever you want to call it, now and years ago is in the literature itself. I think this is an important position. And I'm thinking now only quantitatively, by the way. When I was at Michigan in the 30s and 40s, I did finally get around to studying Negro literature. Consider the library of a major American university in the 1940s with a large staff of librarians, which did not have the books on its shelves, which you would expect if you wanted to write a dissertation in Negro literature. If you count, and you know I'm telling the truth, the first point that you all made was one that I was so much in agreement with. The first thing that you have to remember is that one of the things that has affected the public, the American public, and American scholarship, is that there's much more production. Just in the simplest terms, the very simplest terms, much more production on the part of black writers today. You can't begin to name, if you have to sit down, you'd have to have a pretty good memory to name all of the writers that you could mention who were active in the 1970s and the 1980s. As a matter of fact, you really couldn't do it. But I have a feeling that too often when people are talking about Negro literature, their discussion could benefit merely from examining the corpus of the literature itself and from having a sense of perspective about it. My own personal feeling is that if it had been left to traditional scholars in American literature who were white and who were lecturing in their classes on what they had been taught when they got their doctorates, there wouldn't be a course in America except in the, well, there would be some exceptions, But in general terms, the average scholar in American literature who was white was not prepared to desert his own training in order to enter a field in which he did not feel comfortable.
Was that racism?
Well, it was both racism, and it wasn't really racism, and necessarily racism in the sense that you and I think were thinking of the term. It was human.
Partly inertia, in fact.
Partially inertia, yeah. I mean, he didn't know anything about it. He was uncomfortable when you started talking about if for example you introduced an analysis of Invisible Man in detail, and he had just been talking about the Scarlet Letter, you had of course ruined his day, and so you couldn't expect him to come.
If the term racism is part of a universe of discourse where we're talking about exclusion and principles of exclusion, then certainly it seems to me that it would be relevant in this context. Blyden's comments seem to me to be the kinds of words that you expect from a brilliant senior scholar in the field with a long experience. And I think what he's reminded us of is that the period in which Afro-Americans were producing self-consciously literary works of art in any kind of volume is a remarkably short period of time. One of the things that Blyden didn't say but certainly implied, it seems to me, is that from any evaluative standpoint, it is just short of a miracle that a people treated as Afro-Americans have been in America have achieved the brilliant levels, the literary heights that they have within that reasonably short period of time. And it seems to me that the corollaries that are suggested by the kind of increased volume that we have now are, in a sense, a pressure to become a presence within the American literary domain. I think that when we get to that domain and we begin talking about reactions, we are talking about power. To use a linguistic metaphor, people say that the standard language of any country is the dialect that has an army and a navy. So I think when we talk in American literary terms about the classic works, the masterpieces, indeed about an American Renaissance, we're talking about authors who were selected, works that are read under a certain value heading. They are kept as the canon, as the masterpieces, by a certain group of people. They are perpetuated by a system of literary reproduction that is not hard to find. And I think that John earlier was implying that 12 years ago, that system of literary reproduction in this country, the complacency of those people in power who perpetuate a particular canon of American literature was under a heavy barrage, under heavy fire. To round off in terms of your question about the public, and the people who had put that structure under heavy fire were people who quite literally were in the streets of America and were visible on your TV screen, folks, every night, saying, you know, things like, hell no, we won't go, burn, baby, burn, you know, look out, whitey, black power gonna get your mama. And there was not much you could do but respond to that, you know. And one of the responses was a kind of easy, as I mentioned earlier, knee-jerk response. Others, it seemed to me, were more profound.
I think a relevant statistic might be that one black professor taught in a, quote, white university during the whole of the 19th century in America. And during the 20th century up until 1945, I think the figure is five. Five black professors had permanent tenured jobs in, quote, white prestige universities in all of the United States until the end of the Second World War.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first program in a series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order from historical and contemporary perspectives. The panelists are four scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center: Blyden Jackson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Houston Baker of the University of Pennsylvania, John Sikora of North Carolina Central University, and James Olney of Louisiana State University. Here is Blyden Jackson.
One of the points I want to make before we go on, because we're talking about literature, is that for years and years, and it still may be true, the White Academy has been prepared to admit Negro scholarship in certain areas. For example, if you're a sociologist, you'll be taken seriously. So that I do want you to notice that for years and years in the Academy, the major discipline in which you could admit a Negro was one of the social sciences, and it was usually sociology. We used to say as a joke among ourselves that sociology was a Negro subject.
And boys founded it.
Yes,
that's
yeah.
Right.
We had these strange attitudes toward disciplines.
You look at the social matrix of the 1960s, and as you look at it, what you find in literary terms within the 60s, in literary terms within the Afro-American community, is something that is significantly different from what characterized the Harlem Renaissance, that flourishing of Afro-American letters during the 1920s. I think one of the reasons that the output, the production of literary works of art, if you will, or works of expressive culture, a term that I prefer, were so great in number during the 1960s, was because the orientation of leaders, black leaders, of black writers, of people who were concerned with Afro-American expressive culture, was quite different in the 1960s from the orientation of that same group of people in the 1920s. The orientation was, in the 1960s, a mass orientation. It was an orientation toward people who were living ordinary lives, or sometimes lives of quiet desperation, in black enclaves, in cities. The people who were addressed by say college students at A&T here in the South were people who were living ordinary lives, or in some cases lives of quiet desperation, in enclaves in the South. But it was people at large. And the definition, it seems to me, of things like literature, a poet, a novelist, an essayist, a thinker, that those very definitions changed in Afro-American culture or in black life and culture during the 1960s. So that the exclusionary principle that governed an academic perspective simply would not work then if one were trying to characterize or to criticize or to talk about, let us say, the poems of Don L. Lee, Haki Madhubuti, or if one were to talk about the audience that was available for something like Home on the Range, a play by Leroy Jones, or if one were talking about the novels of or a novel like Sam Greenlee's novel, or some of the writings of John A. Williams during that period of time. This is the common definition of audience expectation, form, literary form, methods of distribution were shifted, I think, in rather radical ways. Anytime you could get thousands of people out at the Apollo Theater on a Saturday in the winter in Harlem to listen to poets, the Black Spirits Festival? I mean, anytime you could do that, I mean, something was very, very different in American culture as a whole. All right. And so I think you know, to bring the discussion back to the more literary level, one of the functions, one would say, of the activism and the visibility of people living everyday lives, but en masse in Afro-America, one of the things that happened there was that you had an expressive culture that grew out of that movement. And that changed the definitions of literature, authors.
What are the issues that Afro-American writers or the Afro-American reading public, what are they concerned about? Give me some specific examples of things that have come to the fore, say, in the last 10 or 15 years in literary terms.
I come to that question after listening to your shows on modernism. And I think almost all the principles, ideas, concepts that you discussed in modernism apply with perhaps even greater effect in contemporary Afro-American writing. The desire to have a piece of writing reflect all of experience rather than a bit of it, a la T.S. Eliot. The knowledge that modern experience tends to be fragmentary, and we receive it in fragments, and it's the role of the author to try to put those fragments together, or at least to say that they are fragmentary, a la Ezra Pound. And many of the things that were said about modernist literature, modernist music, apply, I think, with special force to Afro-American literature of the 20th century. That is, of course, one of the ironies, that in searching for representations, the expressive culture of the modern age, critics, scholars for a half a century overlooked the Du Bois, the Jean Toomers, the Langston Hughes, when they could have found it, you know, palpable, vivid, right there in front of them, not having to go to Italy or to France or to London to find it, but you could find it in Savannah and Atlanta and in Harlem. That is, of course, one of the ironies, and it's also a mark of that kind of progress that you were asking about earlier. It's a sign, thinking of this room, the work of James Olney has showed us the extent to which the important contributions of American literature stem very largely from autobiography. And to the extent that autobiography is important in American literature, Afro-American autobiography is extremely important. And, you know, it's a scholar in this room who has brought that to the attention of thousands of people. And they accept that, and they're willing to turn to Afro-American autobiography as a root of American literature and American culture.
When John was saying a little while ago that the canons of American literature have been in the process of transformation recently, and then when Houston a few minutes ago said that, I think, in effect, that what has been happening is that different kinds of expression are being taken for literature now which were not before. Quintessentially the case with autobiography. Nobody considered autobiography as a literary mode until very recently. And I think that it's demonstrably the case that there has not been such a radical alteration in the Afro-American tradition, which is a very real tradition, as Houston has demonstrated, for example, in The Journey Back, but that what has always been there has been disregarded, has been seen as something other than literature, something other than that self-enclosed work which for so long was taken to be the only form of literature, the only form of acceptable literary expression. And I think that what's happened in the expansion of the canon is not only to bring in different groups of people, women writers, Afro-American writers, so on, but to consider different forms of writing as literature. And as John was saying, I think the mode of autobiography has been absolutely central to the Afro-American tradition and remains central to that tradition, I think. And one can see the change, I think, in the fact that just now, John, with Darwin Turner, is editing a volume of essays on slave narratives and considering them in, as a literary form, aren't you? And that, that would hardly have been conceivable, say, 25 years ago. And yet they've always been there. They've been doing the same thing, but they were not perceived in that way until just recently. But and taking, I think, taking the body of Afro-American writing into the whole American canon has not so much altered Afro-American writing as it has the canon of American literature. That's what's being shifted. I don't think Afro-American writers are doing anything so radically different now from what they did 25, 50, and 100 years ago. There's a continuous line. There's a real continuity there. But the transformation, the pushing aside, as it were, moving over a little bit, is taking place in the canon, I think.
That's an excellent characterization by both James and John. One of the early examples that I like of the explosion of blackness in the middle of what is supposed to be an exclusionary tradition. No, sir, boss, all the doors are closed and there couldn't possibly be no black folks in here. And suddenly one finds Phyllis Wheatley saying, an Ethiop tells you this, ye blooming plants of human race divine. And this is a black woman in the 18th century talking to Harvard students and telling them how to act and how to behave themselves. And she's telling them from a cosmogonic point of view. She's not just telling them in terms of a book of manners. She's saying, I am connected with all of the proper earthly and celestial sources to be able to talk to you, you know. Now, I don't mean any offense, she says, you understand. I'm really happy to be here in America, but I am an Ethiop. I inscribe myself in the Rolls of Fame along with Terence and other classical African poets, and I'm talking to you, America. So that America heard black people singing, it seems to me, in very literate forms quite early on. The question of a recognition of those forms by people who were capable then of speaking in ways that made an academic difference or a difference in the academy had to wait a long time. And what has happened then is an inscription, a writing into the record, as it were, of people like Phyllis Wheatley and a long line of her successors, and not only those who followed the classic formal models, but people who took a different tack altogether from Phyllis Wheatley. So that you have a kind of push against what is touted as the mainstream of quote, American literature from the very outset. It's just the inscription of that in the record.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with the first segment in a series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order. The panelists in the conversation you've just heard are Houston Baker of the University of Pennsylvania, John Sikora of North Carolina Central University, Blyden Jackson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and James Olney of Louisiana State University. All four scholars recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.